Sony Electronics against Guardian Media. Mr. Grisalfi.
Good afternoon. The district court erred as a matter of law in granting Guardian's motion to dismiss the appellant's consolidated actions below for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. The district court failed to recognize
that as a matter of law or
as a matter of law, Your Honor.
Rather than as a matter of discretion.
As a matter of law. There were two parts to the district court's ruling, Your Honor. One was on the jurisdictional question itself, and then the court also found that even if there were jurisdiction, it would exercise its discretion to decline the case. So it's our position that the district court, though, erred as a matter of law in failing to recognize that an express charge of infringement of an ongoing activity alone creates an actual controversy under the Declaratory Judgment Act sufficient to support jurisdiction.
Does MedImmune have any effect on this case?
I think it does, Your Honor. I think what the MedImmune case does is it lowers the jurisdictional bar in this case. So, but we believe that we have jurisdiction even under the court's two-part jurisdictional test.
But in MedImmune, the Supreme Court specifically went out of its way to tell us it didn't like our two-part test, didn't it?
That's true, Your Honor. The court did. And I think in MedImmune, the court backed up, and basically what it's talking about in the new MedImmune decision is we're left with, you need a substantial controversy between parties having adverse legal interests, and the controversy has to be a sufficient immediacy and reality to give jurisdiction. And that's the test that we're left with from MedImmune. But I still think that this court's two-part test, if it is met, in fact, there will be jurisdiction. I think if the two-part test is not met, I think there's still...
The question is, do we look at the two-part test at all after MedImmune? Is the Supreme Court telling us, in effect, no more special tests in patent litigation? Declaratory judgments are declaratory judgments no matter what the subject, and you apply the general standard that a district court would apply in any declaratory judgment action if it was a dispute over real property. The same standard, the same basic standard, should be applied.
Your Honor, they very well may be doing that. And I think that I'm prepared today to talk about the more general standard, and I think we certainly meet jurisdiction under that, because I think this court's two-part test, and in particular the reasonable apprehension prong of that test, is a harsher standard. It's a more stringent standard. But I think below, the district court even erred on that harsher standard.
Before time runs out, let me just move you. I know, let's assume, for the sake of this question, that we agree with you on the jurisdiction issue. And let's assume, for the sake of this question, that we also agree that at least a number of the criteria the district court used to say that even if he had jurisdiction, he would not exercise his discretion, like this is a close case, are also incorrect. You're still left, are you not, with at least the comments made by the district court on the re-exam and certain aspects of the litigation that would warrant, at a minimum, would they not, are sending it back for a remand, remanding it back to the court to reconsider on the discretionary prong.
Your Honor, if you're asking me, you know, do I think we should remand the case based on the comments on the reexamination, I would say no, because this is a case where you have clearly have jurisdiction under Article 3 under the Declaratory Judgment Act.
Right.
The idea that the district court looked at the fact that we filed a re-examination as a delay and something that was inconsistent with the Declaratory Judgment Act is wrong. It's not inconsistent at all. I think what we were looking for is to secure a convenient forum for the witnesses, etc., and at the same time filing a re-examination so we can have a logical stage proceeding here.
Why is it clearly unreasonable when you all went in for a re-exam, and if the point of one of the things we look at in declaratory judgment is to alleviate the uncertainty as to your legal rights, and then you go and get a declaratory go in for declaratory judgment and then want to stay it indefinitely, why isn't that at least a factor that we ought to let the district court consider? Why is that an improper factor for the district court to consider?
Because, Your Honor, I do not think it overrides the clear factor that we have jurisdiction. I mean, we had clear charges of infringement below, putting us in apprehension.
Yeah, but the infringement charge was brought by, what's his name, Mr. Vogel, is that right?
That's correct.
And the litigant is not Mr. Vogel, it's Guardian. We don't know what the relationship is between Mr. Vogel and Guardian, do we?
Your Honor, we don't, but we can surmise that for the fact that he sold the patents for $20, that clearly he has an interest in this case.
What he may have done is sold the patents for a nominal amount and may have some understanding that he'll get a percentage of anything they can recover either as under license or under litigation.
That's correct, Your Honor. So I think he does have an interest in the case. But even so, under the court's precedence, I think that Guardian needs to be charged with the conduct of its predecessors. This has been done.
Are there any cases which say that a successor in this situation is charged with respect to a claim of infringement, that the claim of infringement made by the predecessor must be attributed to the successor? I'm not talking about generally. Generally, successors have to take over what they got, but this particular... I mentioned it because it was, about 6 years between the time that you filed your declaratory judgment suits and the time when this charge was made.
Your Honor, yeah, I think it was roughly 4 years, but there are several cases, I think, that bear on this, and we've cited them in our briefs. We have the electromechanical case, and there it was actually a case of reasonable apprehension, and the district court charged that the activities of the predecessor were in fact attributable in that case going forward. So there is a clear case in terms of reasonable apprehension, and it's also been done in the context of latches and in the context of estoppel. You have the Eastman Kodak case and the Dymo case, and they're all cited in our briefs. So clearly, Your Honor, that you do attribute the conduct to the predecessor, because if you didn't do that, it would be like wiping the slate clean. And you would start over.
Let me make sure that I understand what you're not arguing. You're not saying that after Guardian acquired the patents and an officer of Guardian undertook the licensing negotiations and the various conversations, you're not saying that some more relaxed standard that might follow from MedImmune applies to those conversations.
Well, Your Honor, I think the facts we have here is the 1999 predecessor letters were clear charges of infringement. Several years did go by, but I think when Guardian got a hold of the patent, they renewed those charges of infringement by providing claim charts that matched up specific claims to specific products. And we think this renewal of the charges clearly raised a reasonable apprehension under the two-part test. So we think that we have jurisdiction.
You said they had claim charges. I assume if suddenly I'm informed by someone that they think I'm infringing their patent, the first thing I want to know is, well, what are you talking about? Show me. What does the language of your patent say? And what? In which ways do you think my product infringes it? Now, is that enough to show a threat of infringement of suit? Claim of infringement?
Clearly, under the facts of this case, the answer to that is yes. In 1999, we had Guardian's predecessor write us two letters, and in both letters they say, you infringe our patent, you infringe this claim with respect to this product, and this claim with respect to this product. They provided claim charts. They made these accusations in 1999. We told them your patents were invalid, and we thought they went away. Then they sold their patents to this patent holding company, whose sole purpose it is to go out and assert these patents. And they came back and they said, here it is again, and it's the same claim chart. It's the same matching up of the claims and the products. Of course we were going to believe we were subject to suit. This happens all the time. In fact, I recall being here in an appeal in another VCHIP case, with the SoundView case, where we had a litigation with these patent holding companies that have bought these VCHIP patents. We thought we were going to get sued. There's no question about it. And clearly there's jurisdiction in this case under the two-part test and also under the Supreme Court's guidance in MedImmune with respect to there being a substantial controversy.
In other words, you're saying that even if we were to just take the sending of the claim charts by Guardian in 2006, that ought to constitute a charge of infringement sufficient to warrant jurisdiction?
In light of the circumstances of this case, absolutely.
Can I just take you back to the discretionary issue that I was speaking of? It seemed to me, and maybe I misunderstood, that part of your answer to my question about discretion was, the court had jurisdiction. But the two are separate, are they not? And under MedImmune, even with the Supreme Court ruling as it did on the jurisdictional question, it still said, well, wait, we've still got this remaining inquiry with respect to the court's discretion, and we're going to send it back for the court to consider. So you agree with that, right?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so the question does remain that in and of itself, is the re-exam issue at least a reasonable factor for the judge to consider? Your briefs, I think, dealt with a lot of the other factors that he considered. Clearly, at the juncture which he looked at the case, it wasn't his number one factor. It was like number five on the list.
Correct.
But why wouldn't we be obligated to at least send it back to the judge to see what his view is of that, or maybe other factors that haven't come to the light yet?
Well, Your Honor, I think reading the district court's decision, there were two primary reasons the court mentioned. One was, as Your Honor mentioned, that it was a close case. Well, clearly, in our view, it wasn't a close case because the district court made an error of law. The district court did not recognize that a charge of infringement, at least under the court's more stringent two-part test, was in fact sufficient to meet the reasonable apprehension prong. And the court clearly didn't understand that. That was evident from the hearing below, and it's evident in the opinion. The second primary reason the district court gave was because the court thought that the appellants were engaged in a litigation strategy that for commercial purposes that it said was aimed at gaining an advantage, a tactical advantage in licensing negotiations. And clearly the record doesn't support that at all. There's nothing in this record to show that the appellants did anything that was improper. And with respect to this idea that...
No, but I'm asking you explicitly, and the court did. I mean, he may have not said it's number one or number two, but the court clearly relied, at least in part, on the fact that you come in, you want a DJ, and then immediately you ask for a stay so you can go to the re-exam.
Your Honor, I think the court could reconsider that again, but I just think in the facts of this record, if that's the only fact and we're back up here before this court, I think it would be an abuse of discretion. That was all that the court relied on.
Let me ask you a somewhat related but different question. Let us assume for the sake of argument that we conclude that under MedImmune we have a different standard now for determining declaratory judgment jurisdiction. Why isn't it the appropriate step for us, instead of trying to decide who's right under the new standard, to send it back to the district court in the first instance to apply the new standard?
Well, Your Honor, I think the court could, in fact, do that, but I think...
Well, yeah, we could. My question is, why isn't that the appropriate... When a new standard is announced, normally what the appellate court does is send it back to the trial court to reconsider the case under the new standard.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not going to resist the court thinking that it's appropriate to send it back. It could very well be appropriate to remand the case.
But is your view of MedImmune that clearly anything that would have been appropriate for jurisdiction in the pre-MedImmune situation is also still appropriate for jurisdiction under MedImmune? In other words, MedImmune expanded.
Yes.
But in no way contract it.
Is that your view of the
state of the law?
It is, Your Honor.
Because if that's true, then I thought your answer might be that if our view is that you would have had, the court should have had jurisdiction under the pre-MedImmune standard, our inquiry could end there. Is that your view?
It is my view, Your Honor, because I do think that the court's two-part test is a more stringent standard than what the Supreme Court seems to be saying in the MedImmune case. And I think there's no question about it that we have met the court's traditional two-part test in this case. And I think we also have met the Supreme Court's standard with respect to being a substantial controversy between parties having adverse legal interests with sufficient immediacy in reality. I think we've met that as well.
So if, in fact, on whatever basis we were to think that the court had jurisdiction, you still have an outstanding motion for a stay, is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is the reexamination proceeding? Did the office agree to reexamine?
On March of 1996, the Patent Office found that all claims that were asserted were invalid or unpatentable. And that's the current state of the reexamination.
Is that challengeable? I'm just curious. Is that challengeable before the Board of Appeals and the Patent Office, or is that the end of it?
No. It's certainly challengeable before the Board of Appeals.
And the patent expires next year?
2008, which is another reason why the court may not want to remand.
Okay, let's hear from the other side. Is that all right?
That's fine.
We'll save you rebuttal time. We've
Thank you.
Run over somewhat. Okay, Mr. Stanley.
Please, the court. First, I will address MedImmune. MedImmune does not change this court's jurisprudence with respect to the two-part test at all. The only thing MedImmune held was that payments made under an existing license after there's been an express threat of patent litigation to enjoin the patent or to enjoin the party and to award treble damages doesn't eliminate the apprehension of suit. And that's the limit. The court, under this court's jurisprudence, you wouldn't even reach the reasonable apprehension of suit test because this court's jurisprudence says that there's an express threat of litigation, of patent litigation. That's the end of the inquiry.
But you say that's all that MedImmune decided. What about footnote 11 where the court, it seems to me, went out of its way to tell us that it said a couple of our principles were inconsistent with a prior Supreme Court decision. Isn't it telling us that we got it wrong in those cases?
The two distinguishing factors are, one, there was an existing license contract, and two, there was an express...
No, but I'm talking about what the holding in MedImmune was. Sure, it's dictum, but we can't just ignore Supreme Court dictum, can we?
Well,
I
think this is important because I think if you think MedImmune, you know, changed the law, I'd probably need 12 of you up there because I don't think it changed your law at all. I think it's fully consistent with your existing precedent. If you look at the cases cited in the footnote, they are contract cases. The Aetna case is a case where there's a dispute under an existing insurance contract about whether the party was disabled. The party quit paying premiums because under the contract, if he was disabled, he quit paying premiums. The insurer came to the court and said, well, I want to know whether I have to reserve life insurance payments if this fellow dies. I think his contract has lapsed.
But how do you deal with the first sentence of footnote 11, which says, even if Alkwater could be distinguished as an injunction case, it would still contradict the Federal Circuit's reasonable apprehension of suit test or, in its evolved form, the reasonable apprehension of imminent suit test, citing Teva against Pfizer. It seems to me what the court is saying is, we're deciding in MedImmune the question of a license. But while we're at it, we're going to tell you, Federal Circuit, you got it wrong in those other cases as well. That's what it seems to me to be saying. And it is somewhat unusual for the Supreme Court to go out of its way and write a footnote telling the Court of Appeals that it was wrong on an issue not directly presented in the case.
If you go back to the GEMPRO case, which was the start of this court's holding that payments under a license obliterates, if I remember the court's words, the reasonable apprehension of suit test, if there's a threat, an express threat of litigation, and in MedImmune, the Supreme Court's decision starts from the premise that there's an express threat of patent litigation, you would never reach the reasonable apprehension of suit test. And all the Supreme Court held in that case is that the acts of the party in paying payments under coercion doesn't eliminate the threat of litigation, which is more than an apprehension of suit, but an express threat of suit.
What it seems to me you're arguing is that the Supreme Court was wrong in what it said in footnote 11.
I'll try one more time.
The Supreme Court seems to say one thing in footnote 11, and you say, but it really wasn't necessary, and there was no reason for it to say so, and the cases it cites don't support it, so therefore we should sort of ignore it.
The Supreme Court reversed you on the proposition that if you're paying royalties under a contract, that eliminates the apprehension of suit. Now, If you look at...
And that's not true, and certainly in this case, if the appellants had accepted your offer for a license, your view wouldn't be, therefore, you're subject to a D.J. action, right?
If they filed a D.J. action after we entered a license, then we would be left with the questions that aren't this case with respect to, are they stopped? Are they allowed to do that the day after they...
Wait, so you're agreeing that they would have been... So your position is they would have been better off in terms of their ability to get a D.J. if they had accepted your license. If they had accepted your deal for a license, then they could go in under MedImmune and get a D.J. It's simply because they didn't accept your license offer that they don't have the ability... Does that make any...
They could file a D.J. The question is whether or not that D.J. still could be dismissed under discretion because there's a payment of license. The Supreme Court made clear that the unique and substantial discretion under the D.J. Act is still completely intact, and if they filed a D.J. the day after they signed a license agreement, that would be a grounds, I think, for a district court to say, I'm still not going to hear this case.
But I'm talking about jurisdiction now. I'm not talking...
Okay,
clearly, MedImmune leaves discretion out.
Right.
I'm talking about jurisdiction. So you're suggesting that in order to get a D.J. in this case, if they had accepted your license, then they'd be eligible to file a D.J. But because they didn't accept your license, that's the basis upon which they don't have reasonable apprehension or threat or whatever it is, the standard or express charge of infringement.
The Supreme Court said that that doesn't eliminate, you know, an express threat of litigation. But in that case, when the party came to Genentech and said, I'm paying royalties under protest, Genentech threatened them with litigation. That's consistent with your test. And all the Supreme Court says is that...
Well, is the threat there? I don't want to put you on the spot. I mean, you all have not briefed MedImmune, and maybe that would have been helpful. But reading from the Supreme Court's opinion, there's a letter there, and they characterize it as saying that the petitioner was covered by the patent and that he owed royalties under the agreement. If that's what constituted the threat under MedImmune that was sufficient, how is that different from what happened in this case? Is that more of a threat, saying that you're covered by the patent and that you owe royalties under the agreement? Isn't that analogous to the facts here?
No, the threat here, the Supreme Court said that the letter is a clear threat to enforce the patent, terminate the agreement, and sue for patent infringement, not just for back royalties or unpaid royalties.
Is that what the letter said, or is that their characterization of what the threat was?
They characterized it on page 2 of the slip opinion, which is what I'm working on. They say they considered this letter to be a threat, and at the top of page 9 of their opinion, they said they allege without contradiction a threat by respondents to enjoin sales of royalties not forthcoming. The only way you can enjoin sales is to threaten a patent infringement suit.
They really were trying to harmonize Lear against Atkins, weren't they, with the general declaratory judgment principles. And if one does that, then I suppose it would support the action, even when there isn't a contract, wouldn't it?
If there was an express threat of patent litigation, and that's one of the things under this court's test, and that's something that's important. In the Arrowhead case, they rely on the fact that there's a charge of infringement. And under this court's precedent, that charge of infringement has to be a threat of litigation, not just a charge of infringement done in the context of initiating or continuing license negotiations.
This really takes us back to the point that I think what was bothering Judge Friedman as well is that MedImmune, even though it was dealing with Lear against Atkins and dealing with the existence of a license and the continuing existence of a license, weren't they also saying that one needs to liberalize access to the courts when, in fact, there is a genuine apprehension, no matter how delicately phrased the approach by the patentee is?
That assumes that every patent negotiation will end in either a license or a lawsuit.
Yes,
and I think that this court has precedent, starting with Shell Oil and BP Chemicals and the Phillips case, where even the EMC case recognizes that there's no way that you can initiate a discussion over a patent without the fact that it's a right to exclude looming over the context. So
no, it doesn't say no way. Shell Oil used the word jawboning, which sort of bothered me at the time, but they were talking about the conversations that take place between patentee and the person that they'd like to take a license. There would certainly have to be some lines drawn, but I think one of the things the Supreme Court was doing was recognizing that somewhere along the way there are going to be lines that a lot of these are questions of fact, not questions of law. But the delicate phrasing to avoid the overt threat, I think now it needs to be put in the larger context of what really is the relationship between the parties. And there's no question about that.
All right. For purposes of this case, I want to turn to the discretion part. Assume that jurisdiction exists merely by having a patent. Somebody knocks on the door, says, I want to talk to you about your patent.
Well, assuming there's an express charge of infringement that doesn't require express threat of litigation, why don't we take that as the hypothetical?
Right, okay. Well, the hypothetical, I mean, I think under your Arrowhead case, which is the one they rely on, it's clear that in that case, the court found the letters, which in that case expressly referenced litigations, as skirting being an express charge of infringement. And the court reached the reasonable apprehension of suit test, which they wouldn't have done if it was an express charge of infringement. So I think that this court cannot hold that any discussion of it's covered by the patent or you might need a license is an express charge of infringement without having to overrule Phillips and Shell and all those cases that talk about in a license negotiation, you're allowed to say, I think you need a license, you know, this is why it covers your claims. But assuming the threshold for jurisdiction, constitutional jurisdiction is as low as you want to make it, there's an independent ground for affirming the result in this case on the ground of discretion. And you asked about, do we have to remand? Your EMC case versus Norin makes it clear that you don't have to remand because the district court's discretion was not altered by MedImmune. It was, in fact, it was reaffirmed as being a unique and substantial discretion to decline jurisdiction. In EMC, the district court in that case did not find whether or not there was jurisdiction. It said it's too complicated, but I'm going to exercise my discretion to decline it. And this court ruled as a matter of law that there was a controversy in that case, but still affirmed that court's exercise of discretion. Because the whole assumption that's...
Oh, certainly. I mean, I don't know that there's any disagreement. I mean, in MedImmune, the Supreme Court sent it back to the district court, recognizing that given jurisdiction, there's still a role for the district court to play. Don't you read MedImmune as saying the same thing?
No, that there's a big difference. Okay. This is really important. In MedImmune, the district court never addressed the issue of discretion. If the district court said, there's no jurisdiction, I'm bound by Gen Probe, that issue was not discussed. In EMC, which this court affirmed, this court actually held as a matter of law, based on the undisputed evidence, that there was a controversy, but still affirmed the district court's exercise of discretion. And that's exactly this case. Even if you assume there's jurisdiction, you have to independently review for abuse of discretion whether the district court's ruling that this isn't the proper time to take this case is correct.
Well, that's the problem you have, is if we're there, we're reviewing whether or not the judge abused his discretion, and you've got reliance on a number of factors that if we reach jurisdiction, we might very well reject. For instance, his factor number one is this is a very close case. If we think jurisdiction is clear, we might have to throw out that factor. So what are you left with? I mean, the one I was left with was the re-exam, as I asked.
Well,
I
think we're left with two main ones in addition to the re-exam. But one, the district court found, as a matter of fact, that this was a coordinated strategy for commercial reasons, that they were trying to influence the price or the value of the patent in the marketplace. And the district court found, as a matter of fact, he heard both sides' evidence and said, this is how I see it, and that is a fact-finding subject to Rule 52.
But what was the basis for that finding? Is it the fact that they once they terminated the negotiations, they sued the very next day or that day? Is that the basis for it?
No, in that case, it did have an effect in the marketplace, and there was from Mr. Dowler had a declaration that pointed out that at least one party quit negotiating with them. They said when the three biggest or four biggest companies in the industry filed a DJ, we're perfectly content to sit on the sidelines
But it's not clear to me why coordinating litigation for commercial reasons is such a bad thing. I mean, everything the parties do is for commercial reasons, right?
But if you look at how the discretion was exercised and affirmed in the EMC case, exactly that same scenario was presented. And this court, regardless of what you think about the jurisdictional standpoint, you can't reach a different result in this case without overruling EMC, because the EMC Norad, that case this case has better facts than EMC for affirming the exercise of discretion. The other thing about this is the district court did rely on the fact that this case, at the time that it was filed, did not serve the purposes of the DJ Act, because they weren't trying to get an early resolution or clear the air. They filed their suit, then immediately went, they waited 3.5 months to serve the thing. They then went to the patent office and went that route. They then moved to stay their own litigation. And those things are exactly the reason why the district court said, I shouldn't take this case now. And even from the standpoint of a remand, I mean, you know, we pointed out in our brief when they were trying to talk about the events happening post the closing of the record in this case, if you remand this case, it really doesn't make a lot of sense because other things have happened and they probably file a different complaint. So on this record, on what's before the court, I don't think you can hold that this is an abuse of discretion for this court to decline, for the district court to decline any jurisdiction that may be found to exist, whatever the standard for jurisdiction
is. Well, wait a minute. Why does it not make any sense, I mean, just in and of itself, for us to remand it? Is there something that's been mooted out by this case? I mean, would that just not be something to do for other reasons that are beyond the, you know, what's been argued in the briefs?
Well, I mean, depending on what you do in terms of what kind of opinion you write, in terms of, I mean, obviously you need jurisdiction in order to be able to exercise the discretion. But even if the from a standpoint of whether or not there's jurisdiction, the district court on this case, in this record, on this DJ, this complaint, these set of four consolidated complaints, did not abuse its discretion in saying, even if there's jurisdiction, I think this doesn't fit the policies of the DJ Act. And if you should affirm that decision, and then leave the parties to their future negotiations or future business dealings or commercial activities. But it doesn't, to go back and tell the court to go back to the state of time at the time this complaint was filed, it doesn't really make any sense. But just from the standpoint of should this be affirmed on this record, this case is controlled by the Noran, AMC Noran case, because it has the same policy concerns. That case involved a non-manufacturing patent owner that was only looking for...
I have a question I want to ask you just specifically. Is it your position that despite MedImmune, we could continue to apply the reasonable apprehension of suit test?
Yes.
Yes.
I think MedImmune is consistent with the reasonable apprehension of suit test.
Okay. That's all I wanted to know. That's your position.
Okay. Any more questions?
No.
Nope. Any more questions? Thank you, Mr. Stanley. Okay, you have your rebuttal times.
Your Honor, unless there's specific questions, I would see the remainder of my time.
Well, I'd like to ask you about EMC if you have a response to that.
EMC?
Yeah.
Well, I think, Your Honor, in the EMC case, I think the facts were much different. I believe in the EMC case, there were clear negotiations going on in that case. I think the parties were exchanging terms. And I think the facts in the record were, I think that was the case where the president actually said, after he filed the complaint, that, well, we just filed it to protect our action, but we still want to continue to talk with you. So that's very different from this case. There were never any negotiations in this case. The appellants in this action always believed these patents were invalid and followed that up with a reexamination. And now the United States Patent Office has, in fact, shown that we were, at least so far, correct in that. We never offered the side, Guardian, any terms. We never offered them money or any consideration at all. The only negotiations were that they would call up, say, we want tens of millions of dollars, and we would say, your patent's invalid. That's not negotiation, so I don't think this fits within the EMC case.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you both. The case is taken under submission.